Hey, welcome to Press Start, how to become a game developer. I'm Adam Marissa Smita, CEO of Arsenesia and Vice President of Indonesia Game Association, will be your host for this episode. Like usual, in this podcast, we will talk about game development and how to start your career as a game developer. We will invite experts from the game industry to tell us their game dev journey to inspire us. I hope this podcast can help you to start to become a game developer. And there will be a new episode every Thursday, so don't miss it. And this podcast is brought to you by Indonesia Game Association and Goethe Institute Jakarta. So today we're having a very, very special guest from Germany. He already works in a lot of game company, from small studios to large studios, and now he founded his own development studio called Twin Drums, and currently working on a PC game which is really, really interesting project called the Wagadu Chronicles. I will say hi to our guest today, Alan. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm great. How are you?
Great. It's really, I'm so happy to have you in this podcast. Thank you for coming to this podcast. By the way, where are you right now?
So I'm currently in Berlin, Germany. Actually, I have two locations. Like in winter, often I'm in Ghana, Accra, West Africa. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the year, I'm in Berlin.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Alan, before we start, maybe can you give us some quick introduction about yourself and what is your role in game industry right now?
Yeah, so I'm Alan. I'm Italian Ghanaian. I grew up mostly in Europe, but as I've said, I've lived in Ghana as well, West Africa. I started in the industry in big tech, then kind of switched to marketing in gaming, and then eventually to game design. And now, since a couple of years, I've started this company called Twin Drums, working on this indie MMO, the Wagadu Chronicles, as you said. I actually had a lot of experience in mobile as well. So, for instance, I worked on the Candy Crush franchise, among others. But now I'm kind of focusing on a PC game for now. In future, let's see, it might become other platforms as well, but it's PC.
Ah, wow, that's going to be an interesting topic for us to talk about too. So, Alan, before we start our discussion, usually we have some kind of rapid question. But don't worry, there's no right or wrong. There's no leaderboard. So there's no scoring in this question. Just to give a little bit understanding about who you are and what you like to play. So are you ready for some question?
I hope so.
All right. Okay, Alan, do you remember what is the first game that you played?
I'm pretty sure the first one was Lemmings, because I remember the tragic feeling of Lemmings blowing up and trying to save as many as possible. So I think I kind of loved it, but it traumatized me as well. It was love and hate at the same time.
Love and hate. And that's the first. And what is the last time the game that you played before coming to this podcast?
I think it was it's Mass Effect, the Legendary Remaster, because I actually almost I never played Mass Effect when it was a big thing, because I at the time I was broke and I couldn't afford a good computer. So like now later in my life, like I need to play this, and the remaster is a perfect occasion for it.
True. Mass Effect, nice. Okay, next question. What is the game with the longest hour that you play?
So, in general, I'm not sure. It might be some online game, I assume, like maybe Ultima Online at the time. You know, there was no tracking of like how many, But I do think in recent time, the last couple of years, is Fire Emblem, because the latest Fire Emblem on Switch, because during the pandemic, I had more time, I was home, and it came out, and yeah, so I spent, I think, like, it was the first game in a long time in which I invested 100 hours.
Ooh, okay, nice. Yes, because of the pandemic. Okay, this is related with the next question. Alan, what do you miss the most because the pandemic, like, the first thing you do if the pandemic is done?
Good question. And I think spontaneity, because now like it feels many things have to be planned and it's like you have to do tests and I mean, many things cannot do them, of course, but even if you can, you have to plan them ahead to make sure you have a test or something. And before it was just like, hey, let's hang out, let's do this. So I think everything feels very planned now.
But in Berlin, like everything already goes back to normal, right? You can go outside, you can hang out.
Yeah, like I guess compared to other parts of the world, it's okay. But as I said, like now things are not as spontaneous as before. So that's one thing. But there's been worse periods, so I don't want to complain too much. There's periods when you literally couldn't leave your house, right? So it's better at least.
All right. So that is for the question. So the audience can know more about you, what kind of game that you like to play. Maybe they can also guess your age by the first game you play. Okay, so
it was already an old game when it came out. but I'm definitely not Gen Z.
Okay. So, Alan, so in this podcast, usually we're going to talk about your journey in the game industry. And most of the listeners in the podcast, maybe they are new or they want to start to jump in the industry and maybe they need to know how to start it. So for the first question, for the starter, my question is like, do you remember when was the first time you want to become or you want to work at the game industry and what is the trigger?
Yeah, interesting one because... I think, you know, I know some people who, as teenagers or even as children, they knew that was it. You know, they want to be in the industry. That wasn't my case. And I think I grew up, mostly in a country, Italy, where there wasn't much of a gaming industry compared to like the US or even the UK or France. I think at the beginning, my first thought was maybe I could do like write some tabletop game design work. But even that was like very niche and, you know, you couldn't really make money out of it in most of Europe, I would say. So not to speak of Africa. So actually, I think it was later when I was working in a big tech company. I was running a Dungeons & Dragons game for a person in the gaming industry. And at some point, and I realized, oh, these people exist. They're real. They actually, you know, it's like seeing a person and them telling me about their job. And they worked on Plants vs. Zombies, which was one of my favorite games a while before that. So I kind of got really excited, asked lots of questions. And I realized, oh, that's the thing. You can do this. And I was like, maybe one day I could do this. And then a couple of years later, I managed to switch and get into the gaming industry.
Do you remember in what age do you start to want to be a game developer?
So this was, I was like in my early 20s when this happened.
Early 20s.
Yeah, so I'll say later than other people.
Mm. And then how do you start it? I mean, do you took class to master the skills and then apply in a game dev? Or what is your step to go to inside the industry?
Yeah, so I kind of did two big steps in my case. One of them was very tailored to my own experience because I had, and that's a tip I'll give in general, like, you know, just always remember to think about your own experience and your own leverage, and you might have something that someone else hasn't got and try and use that to get into the industry. So in my case, I'd worked for a large American tech firm and I had that on my CV and that experience, which helped, of course, very different from gaming, but at the same time, to some extent, it could help. And because I worked in marketing and sales, what I did was like switching into the gaming industry while staying in sales and marketing. Even if I knew I wanted to do game design down the line, I was like, you know, it's easier to change one thing at a time. So I was like, okay, I have this knowledge. Let me see if I can switch. It was actually quite hard. It wasn't easy. I had to apply to first, I think I made the mistake of applying directly for game design jobs without knowing much about the role and having anything. Yeah, so I kind of failed. That was people can learn from my failure. This was the first failure. Just like straight away, was like, oh, I have all this energy. I want to do this. Let me just start applying to all of these game design jobs. And, you know, it was not working out. So I was like, oh, no, you know, what am I doing wrong? So I realized I made a step back and went like, let me apply for marketing jobs within the industry because at least there's something I know, which is marketing. And that eventually worked out. Of course, another thing I did was like, lowering my position. So I was in a mid position before, and I kind of went down, I crashed back to intern, which was like, of course, a big sacrifice financially and everything. But it worked out. I actually got, I think at some point I had two different offers. I had to pick, three actually, so that went very well. But that was because I focused on the field, I knew marketing, and I went very low as well. I was very open to any position, internship, trainee. And that was, but the thing is that was just the first step, because then from there, I wanted to switch to game design.
Yeah.
And that was not as easy as I thought either. So what really helped in that case were, I'd say, two things. So one was doing game jams. So actually building a portfolio. Like, I started going to game jams, great for portfolio, started having some little games there, great to actually learn how games are done. And I would say to people, making a small game and a very large game are closer than you think. They're very different, but closer than you think. The process and everything, some way, you know, the basics are there. And another thing is networking. I did, like, through these game jams and game events, I got to meet developers. And later, when I sat in front of my first proper game design interview, these game designers had seen me at two different events. I'd even spoken with them, asked them questions already, so they were very impressed. They were like, you were at that game, you came to the office before for that event. And I was asking questions and stuff. So that was really helpful. And I think that helped me get that position, that internship position. And that was for King, the company that develops Candy Crush.
How long it takes for you from marketing to switch into game design?
So
like doing game jam and so?
Yeah, I'll say more or less a year, because what I did is, I was not just doing game jams, but I did go, as you mentioned, to school as well. So I did combo both. Yeah. And that was a bit of an investment because, you know, of course, I had to work part-time in the evenings. It was very tough to kind of support myself. It was a full-time thing. But this plus all of the side game jams and portfolio work, plus going to all the events and doing as much research as possible. I was even writing blogs. I think Gamma Sutra published a couple of things. The kind of the student part of Gamma Sutra. In the end, it all worked out.
Interesting. You really did a really, really, like, a lot of things. You did a game jam, you network, you also write a blog. I think that's really, really interesting way to put yourself on the map as a game designer, right?
Yeah, that's the goal.
Yes, and when you apply for a game designer, usually what is the thing that is being looked as a, hey, this is a good portfolio for a game designer?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question, because now I'm literally currently even hiring a game design intern for my company. So I can think about it both from, like, my experience on one side and then my current experience from the other side of the barricade. And definitely I'd say being hands-on. So, like, as I said, like, having made things, like, not just games, but it could be like just like being a modder, imagine, like, modding levels of a game. You know, you show that you're hands-on. You're going into some engine or something, or some game creator tool, and doing things. It shows that you're not just, like, lazily sitting there and then having ideas, because we know that that's something that, you know, is kind of cheap. I mean, good ideas are still great ideas, don't get me wrong, you know, you need to show more than that. You do more than good ideas. And so being hands-on. Another thing is being communicative. So your CV needs to look good. The way you speak needs to be great. You need to practice. You don't have to be an extrovert. You can be an introvert, but you need to practice how to communicate as well, either networking or interviews. And again, there's techniques even as an introvert to do this. So you don't have to go like, oh, no, you know, I'm shy. That's fine. You can be shy and still be a great game designer or game design applicant, but you have to work on it and practice and get good at communication. So hands-on and communication would be some of the main things. And maybe third thing I'd mention is be analytical. So show that when you play games or look at them or research them, you can get learnings out of them, because you're constantly researching as a game designer. So this would be kind of my three tips.
I see. And is it something that when you open a position as a game designer, is there like university that teaches that kind of thing that you mentioned, like analytical communication and something like that? Or this is something that cannot be achieved in a school and you need to learn it by yourself?
So I know there's controversial opinions on this, like people that say schools are useless, just do everything yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm actually on the other side of the spectrum. I think schools are great. I think you learn a lot. I look back and think what some of the experiences I had at game design school, game development school, were super useful for me. Like even now as an entrepreneur, as a CEO and game designer, I'm using some of the things I learned. But I think it's very important that you actually make the best out of it. So it's not just enough to listen to what your teacher says or can, but you know, ask more questions, do side projects and so on. So really you have to make the best out of it. But I think it really helps because just sitting by yourself, Googling and going on YouTube is really hard. So I think having this guidance of an institution can help. Again, if you don't need it and you manage without, you're awesome. Congrats. Like I found it useful, for instance, and I know many people do as well.
Interesting. All right. So that's for, the tips for everyone who wants to be a game designer. You need to do not only theoretically, but you need to be hands-on. You need to be communicative. And when you play game, you also think about the reasoning and analyze the games. Okay. Continue today your journey. So after you managed to join King as of your first job as a game designer, what is like? I mean, do you find it's like surprised? Like, huh? So this is the real things that game designer do, or like you already expected this is that something that you're gonna do?
Yeah, so I think that's a very interesting question. And I think, as I said, it was more similar than I expected to game development elsewhere. Yes, you know, games like Candy Crush are much bigger. You know, they have hundreds of people behind the franchise and so on. But in the end, you have the same roles. You know, you have game designers, you have our game artists, you know, programmers and so on, producers. So I think it's just a lot of it's scale and specialization. You have maybe more specialized people sometimes, but it's still very similar. Once you get the basics, understand the dynamics of things, you'll be surprised by how similar, even like mobile and AAA, you know, are very similar from this extent. So I think we focus a lot on the differences, but I just want to kind of highlight that there's way more similarities than you think. And for instance, in my current team, we have people from PC experience, console experience, mobile experience working together, and there aren't super big differences. We're kind of like on the same page on most things. So that's one thing. On the other hand, one thing that kind of was new a bit for me is like the focus on data. Like lots, especially live companies that have live games, they're really good at looking at collecting data from players and making decisions influenced or informed by them. They shouldn't be ruled by data, but they're informed by data. And that really actually shaped me a lot as a game designer because I realized, you know, it's a bit art, but it's a bit science as well, our job. So you have to balance it. And that science, a lot of it is data analytics.
I see. This is really surprising because what I thought, like, the mobile area, like the freemium and et cetera within the console PC with the premium game is like two totally different beasts. But you mentioned that it's almost like the same fundamentally.
Yeah, I think the basics are the same. And for I can make an example, like I worked, I currently have in my team an awesome level designer. Mm-hmm. And she, I remember, like a bit shocked me in some way when we worked together, because we worked together as well at King. And she told me like she was doing level design for Candy Crush. But before that, she did level design for like some really hardcore PC games, like shooting and so on. She was working on Warhammer as well. And then she switched back to another hardcore game after King. And I'm like, how are you doing this? Like Candy Crush, shooting, Warhammer. And then like, and she's like, for me, it's kind of all the same. It's like just that the pieces are different, but just kind of thinking about how the player is going to engage. Everything is kind of a puzzle. A level design, either like a big shooter game or, you know, like a matching puzzle game on mobile, they're all puzzles that the player, either through shooting or sliding or so on, has to solve. And it was, for me, kind of my mind, you know, boggling. It's like, wow, this is, it kind of makes sense, but I never thought about it in these terms.
I see. Maybe a lot of the audience curious about what you did as a game designer in King Daily. I mean, how was the flow of a new mechanic, new gameplay that you design from the ideation until it's become implemented into the game usually?
Yeah. So it's, I'd say for companies like that have live games, like Candy Crush or King. There tends to be typically a bit of a distinction within the teams on who is more like working on new things, like new features, as you mentioned, and who's building more content, kind of just adding to the live game. I worked on both. But the example you made is definitely more like creating something new, right? And in this case, you kind of, it's basically like, recreate like a mini game team, a bit like a game jam, if you will, but of course, a bit longer, last maybe weeks or months, creating a feature. And that feature is basically like a game in the game. So let's say you want to create like a new mode that you actually, rather than matching gems, this time you're like touching and everything, and something explodes and magic happens. I'm just making it up. And this like requires design documents, research design documents, mockups, UI, then maybe sometimes a prototype, especially if it's a bit more innovative, or you jump straight to production. The producer is kind of managing this little team, art and so on, implementation later on. And at the end, you basically create this kind of mini game, which is just a feature, and then you put it into the big game. The actually full game. So I feel like everything is almost like fractals. You're like recreating these similar roles and similar processes and structures within the game.
I see. And usually, who's the one who giving the idea? I mean, like, hey, let's make this. Is it from the game designer or from someone else higher that give instruction what next to build?
It really depends. It really depends on the company, on the team. And so I've experienced a lot of different approaches to this. It tends to come, I'll say the two big distinctions are either it comes from like the business side of things. So like data analysts that say like, look, this feature is working super well on this other game that we have or this competitor. So let's have a look on like how we can bring a similar feature in or how can we improve it or add something. And sometimes it comes instead from the more creative side. So typically, yes, game design or production and going like, hey, this is super fun. Players will really enjoy this. We think that would make sense. And very often, too, is like a mix of the two. It's like there is some data, some in this direction. It's like, oh, players are getting a bit bored on this part of the game. And then kind of the creative folks, the game says, like, oh, well, how about doing this? Like, we could really do this type of experience and add this. So it's a bit of a conversation going on between the two elements, like the creative and the business side.
And is there an like when you want to create some new features, do you usually validate it? I mean, like testing to user or just put it based on like the design from the designer?
Again, this depends. You know, it's like very often there's no one straight question because there's lots of variety. But I'll say both. So the answer. The answer would be yes, in the sense that it's both. So sometimes it could go on testing. Sometimes it might go directly. I think it depends on the amount of risk that's perceived as well. It's perceived as something that would really change the experience a lot, and there's little evidence from elsewhere. You would probably want to A-B test that. A-B test, which means like you take a fraction of the user base and expose them to this feature, introduce them to the feature, and then you have the rest of the non-exposed, like normal players, and you compare what's happening. And this is really useful. A-B testing is something that happens in a lot of apps and other type of tech or design products. And then you can see like, oh, you know, the B test, so the people who are being tested, they're playing like a bit more and they're like happier. And you can see because the session's a bit longer and the... Or it could be that actually the test shows that people are leaving the game more. They're actually upset and they're like, you know, churning and so on. So this is super useful kind of to create these almost scientific experiments where you can say, and to do this, you need to break into an A-B test. So to have some people who are not being tested and people who have been tested to see what's happening. But that doesn't always happen. Sometimes if you're very confident, you might just roll the feature or whatever it is straight to everyone.
Interesting. You mentioned about the process when you become a game designer. You have an idea, you make a game design document, and then you sometimes make a prototype of it. Is it something like, do you need to have a programming skill to be a game designer?
The short answer is no, you don't. Longer answer is it helps. And I think it really depends as well, because in teams that are very specialized, like for example, looking... especially towards AAA, for instance, or larger companies in general. Like, you know, I think large mobile companies are quite similar to AAA to some extent. So I think kind of the distinction AAA big versus mobile small is wrong, because you should think more like big mobile console, everything, PC versus small PC console, because you have like, you know, PC games done by one or two people, right? So it's like, I think it's very much about the size of the company. And if you have like a very big team with lots of specialization, then as a game designer in a prototyping team, you're very likely not going to touch much code because you have like a programmer assigned. Like for instance, when I did some prototyping at King, I definitely wasn't doing any Unity, any code or, you know, any Unreal or any, you know, engine at all. Or any proprietary engine. And maybe tweaking some values once a while, but that, even that was very rare, to be honest. But when I did it, for instance, in other experiences in smaller teams, I found myself very hands-on, even doing some scripting inside or, you know, touching the code. So it depends. It depends on what your goal is. And I think one important thing to decide and recommend to every future aspiring game designer is you want to become a more specialized and focused game designer, or do you want to be more generalist indie, for instance, or generalist in general? I decided, for instance, I wanted to be a generalist, so I did not focus that much on my programming skills. I have some super basics, but I never focused too much. Because, I mean, I knew I wanted to be a generalist on many things, and therefore a bit was useful. But let's say you want to become a scripter and focus on like scripting for quests and so on, then maybe you want to focus on that a lot. Or maybe you want to do a narrative and become a narrative game designer, and then there's almost no point in doing it. I think it really depends on which direction you're heading to. So people out there will say like, you have to do it or you don't need it. I'll say, be careful, think about your case, your focus. Another tip is like, look at a lot of LinkedIn profiles of people, roles that you like. Look at what they have. Like, you know, check your dream jobs and dream game designers. Look at their background, look at their skills, look at their previous experiences. And maybe some of them have zero programming or C# or whatever. And then you realize, if that's your goal, maybe you don't need programming in that case.
So for the information to all the listeners, usually what are the specialization role inside game designer? You mentioned a narrative, a scripter. What else that can be focused on the role of game design?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. I'll say almost difficult because there's so many focuses. And I feel like I always see every time, every while I see like a new game design role, it's like, oh, I didn't know this existed. It's like, I would say, yeah, if you had to kind of slice it into two big areas, it would be for me, content designers and system designers. Maybe it's like very like I know someone will post somewhere like, no, I disagree, and they're probably right, but this is one way of slicing it. And I'll say content is everything that adds to a game, like the level design, even narrative, you could say, to some extent, you know, like, so creating things for the game. And then system design is kind of like building the boxes where you put this content, so like kind of designing like the mechanics, etc. But then, you know, there's, if you start going more in detail, there's like really very specific roles, like, you know, I think I've spoken with a combat designer whose job is, I met like a boss combat designer who was just designing combat fights. Yes, for boss. And I think once to, I don't know if I met them, it was a video, but like I saw like a weapon designer, the focus was like just designing weapons, I think for shooters, and balancing them, making sure everything is nice, the UX, the damage, everything. There's, of course, game economists who are basically, they do the economy of a game that has economy, like MMOs, RPGs. So everything, inflation and so on, and pricing and et cetera, and market. Then you have, like, even narrative can be really broadened into, like, more people who are more, like, technical. So they do more, like, procedural narrative, but who are more, like, pure old school writing, like, you know, the more narrative dialogue, not in a traditional way. There's a, you know, if you start, like, kind of brainstorming, you can come up with a lot of different roles, some broader, some it's super useful to research and understand where you want to go. And of course, at the beginning, it's a bit easier to be a bit more generic, but it's good to have a goal in mind as well. It's like, if you want to become a narrative designer, you might maybe get a gig initially like a generalist game designer, but then start like writing more, maybe going to create like these little narrative games yourself with like some of the tools that you find online, and et cetera, building for it.
I see. That's really, really interesting, because the role as a game designer, like in Indonesia itself, is really, really new and not many learn about it. So I think it's going to be a good tips for them to which part they need to be focused, which thing that need to be learned. Okay. So back to your journey, Alan. So you intern as a game designer in King, and then after then you go you moved to full time in King, right?
Or yeah. Yeah, so then I got hired fully by the company, and I did actually two things. So one was like working on Candy Crush, the third one actually, Jali, which I already mentioned. And the other thing was working on some prototyping as well. So I actually was in a prototyping team, and I did work on some, and then later on production of a new game. All of these things were not disclosed. But not, how to say, like released, therefore undisclosed. But it was really awesome experiences because I got to learn how to do like, you know, really professional prototyping with like really high level artists and programmers and so on. At some point, I got really lucky because I was like in a small prototyping team where I was the only game designer. So I really got to kind of push myself and really get a lot of feedback from like game directors and art directors and so on. So really, really valuable experience. And by the way, I think it was more in the past, but I've still met people saying like, oh no, you know, I don't want to do mobile gaming because I'm more interested in PC and console, and mobile is kind of like inferior. And I think that's a really, really, really bad mindset. Let me say, like, if you have this mindset, you should really sit down and think about it, because it's actually blocking you. This is blocking you, because look at me now, you know, like I'm working on an MMORPG, but most of my experience actually comes from mobile, you know. And as I said, like you can translate these experiences. And mobile allows you often on average to be on smaller teams and therefore to be exposed to more things than if you were. Like I think if I had in the last, 6-7 years I've been a game designer, mostly AAA, I might be actually in a worse place now to work on RPG. Could be, because if I'd been kind of pigeonholed into a very narrow role, let's say like doing only level design for 5 or 6 years, for like a shooter or something, I wouldn't have had the experience that I had because I've been prototyping live games, features, content, level design. In smaller teams, especially for mobile games that tend to be a bit smaller, you tend to do so much more. So I think for me, like all this experience was for my personal goal of later, because I knew I wanted to start my own company one day and do my own games. And I knew I wanted to do PC games at some point. It worked out very nicely. It worked out very nicely. Ah. So.
Yes, because so after you work at King, next you create your own company or you work again?
There was another company in between called Wooga, which is mobile, initially Facebook, but now, you know, mostly mobile company based in this is a German company, whereas King is actually Swedish British. With them, I at that point I become a lead, which is really interesting because I got many ideas I had at King of like how to do things my way. I kind of got to test them then as a lead later on and go like, you know, does this work if I decide it like this? And that was really cool. So you kind of make your own mistakes and learn your own things. And of course, that was a great experience for me at Stepping Stone to then start my own company when I left Wooga and, you know, 2 years ago now with Twin Drums.
I see. What is the difference between when you are a game designer and you become a lead? Is there any skill that you needed as a lead that you cannot have in a game designer role?
Absolutely. So depending on the company, if you have people to manage in your team, that's one skill, people management. One thing to be very mindful of is that this has nothing to do with game design. Actually, it has nothing to do with anything. Like people management is its own job. And it's kind of like carpentry and painting. I don't know. They're very different jobs. So I think it's very important not to underestimate it. Like many organizations don't realize that if you're a good game designer or game artist or programmer, you might not necessarily be a good people manager. So I think it's very important if you get into such a role to or you want to get for such a role, if your goal is to become a lead designer and have a design team, spend some time on becoming a better manager, on like learn how to do one-to-ones, learn how to understand, communicate people, learn how to support people, how not to micromanage, and how to kind of find a good balance between like giving them freedom and giving them feedback and so on. So that was definitely a very different skill set that I got to hone in this job. Another one is like very much the negotiation level. So when you're dealing with like other stakeholders, like the producer and marketing and so on, like you're much more facing other stakeholders within the organization, within the company, and you being able to you know, maybe pitch something you're working on, or sometimes even protect the team from some pressure. The people want something by this date, and you have to find a way to articulate nicely, like, no, you know, we need more time. You know, these are all things you have to learn how to do. You might not want to do them. Then maybe you're maybe you should stay like more as a senior or principal game designer. But okay, if you're interested, then these are things you get to practice and get good at as a lead game designer.
I see. So when you become lead, is your job as a game designer who design a game become less because you need to also manage people?
Definitely on average, yes. In some companies, let's say you literally stop doing game design and you become mostly a manager and you have like a vision and people management. Luckily, and it's not just luck because it's my choice as well, I've always made sure that I'm actually doing some work, like actual game design, like product work. And even now, as a CEO game designer, I still do game design and I'm really part of the game development team. But of course, it adds a challenge to your time management skills. So that's another super important one. Time management becomes crucial, super important.
What? So I'm going to talk about that with you because especially when you founded your own company, I think that skill really become essential. So Alan, when you decided this is the time for me to make my own company, what makes you sure, like, okay, now I'm ready?
I part of me just wants to reply, you never 100% sure. But I think that's not a useful answer. And then you're going to sack me from the podcast. It's like, go away. So no, jokes aside, I think it's more like a growing feeling. It's like a spectrum. Mm. And I think you have to accept that you're never going to be 100% ready. But it's like kind of you get always closer to 100%, but you never, it just becomes like 90%. Maybe you can hit 99.9999, but it just keeps on adding nines. Like you're never 100% ready. So at some point, you have to pick and say, like, look, I'm doing it now. I'm good. And I would say in my case, what really worked for me was that feeling that I had gathered enough basic experience in most of the things I wanted to do. So, like, I had enough, like, people management, I mentioned, time management, but definitely, like, like live game, because, you know, MMORPGs are live games, so lots of live games experience. System design, prototyping, narrative, like I've done all of those things and I felt it covered. And then I had some things I know I didn't get to do. Like, for instance, I've done mostly mobile and less PC. So, for instance, I made sure that I had people in the team who had a bit more PC experience to maybe compensate, like, some elements. Like, you know, I don't know Steam very well, for instance, right? So, like, stuff like this. So I think it's like you need to get to a point where you know what you need, and you know as well what you don't have, so you can actually make sure that you get it somehow.
I see. How many years do you need to like working until you decided to make your own company?
So in general, if it's a general question, some people manage straight out of university to start their own company, succeed, and some people, really kudos to them. I've met some of such people and they're awesome. So it's different. My approach was a bit more, I want to build experience, learn from others, and then get there. So it's your choice what you want to do. I'll definitely say my path is a bit slightly less risky because you a bit know what you're going into. The other path, I've met people too who, you know, just fresh out of university or whatever, you know, game school and so on, they did startup in games and then kind of maybe didn't work out and they went to companies and they were like, oh, I wish I'd done this later, you know. But then I met people who said, I wish I'd done this earlier. So, you know, it's, I can tell you my story is like, I tend to recommend to get experience elsewhere because I think it really helps you understand as well if you like this and what you want to focus on and give you like some time to build yourself.
I see. How is the process from switching from working in a stable company with stable income to become an entrepreneur? Is it like something that you like having some kind of fear or something like that? Or you can like, it's going smoothly and easily?
So I don't think that there's any single person for whom it goes like super smooth. Maybe if you're like a billionaire, if you're a billionaire, you know, like those self-made people who actually go, oh, but then my parents gave me 1 million, just a bit of pocket yeah. money to help me. And so, then those people maybe like they're super relaxed because, you know, they can yeah. just run back to the villa of the parents and it's like, oh no, I need another million. But unfortunately, that wasn't my case. Actually, it's the opposite. Like, my mom didn't even want me to be in gaming at all. She was like hoping to, like, you know, maybe really? a diplomat or, you know, like doctor or something. Like, I've heard that African parents are similar to Asian parents. So, like, there's a bit this expectation. So, whereas gaming was not on the list of prestigious jobs. So I didn't get like that much support. So, it was definitely there was some stress, but I think it's you can manage the situation to make it less stressful. And one tip would be have some savings. So I had some savings. And another reason actually to have a bit of a career before, as I did, is like that I knew that if things went wrong, I could get another job basically anytime. Like I got to a stage where like even now I still get some inbound requests for people like, are you interested in this? Even if I have my company, it's like, look, I have my startup. I'm not going to quit my startup for jobs. Exactly. Like I'm literally not just, you know, give to someone else. Now, at least it's, you know, too early. So I'm in a position where I feel a bit more relaxed about my finances and future. Like even if I got to a point of burning out all of my savings, at least, you know, I could find another job. So that's important, you know, whereas like if you have no experience, that's a bit more stressful. And another thing is like to put things in perspective, like what's the worst thing that can happen? Like, you know, even if you don't have a job, like maybe you have to move back to your parents for a while. I don't know. You're not going to die. You're not going to starve. At least, you know, I hope so. Hopefully you're not in that. And if you're in such a risky situation, maybe you shouldn't do a startup. Mm-hmm. You should maybe shore up your reserves and finance before. So that would be one thing that really helped a lot. And then to plan, just keep on planning and think about the worst case scenario, because I find it very cathartic to think what happens if things don't go well. And if you think about the scenarios, write them down, you realize, you know, you will survive. You're not going to die. And that really helps you, I think. So that's my tip. Have some savings and plan for the worst. And you realize the worst is still not the end of the world. You can still survive it.
I see. Nice, nice. And then how do you start? What are the steps that you do to start? Do you assemble the team, finding co-founder, or do you first looking for funding, or do you go directly to, I don't know, hiring a lot of people? What the step for you to start the company?
So looking for funding and hiring lots of people works only if you have a super strong CV. Like you were like the game director of like some famous game or something. And then, or at least you're somewhere close to such a role. And then you can just go and say like, oh, you know, I am Sid Meier. Give me money. You know, maybe this is a bit extreme, but you know, like someone like Kojima can just go anywhere and get money. So, you know, maybe you don't need to be that high, but even if you're a bit lower, you're like, let's say a game director of a AAA big company or of like Candy Crush or something, which I wasn't. And then you can go and say like, this is me, give me money. And they'll trust you because they know that if you got that high within that organization, they can give you like 5 million and you're probably going to do, you know, not throw them away, right? Okay. But I was somewhere in between where I have some experience and some good stuff on my CV, but not as strong as to just without a prototype or anything get money. So what I did was like first with my savings and a couple of people that trusted me and, you know, I trusted, build like a little prototype and start kind of having something there. And that's also what most game developers do, build something. I actually even started while still working on my full-time job. So in the evenings and weekends, I started working on it. It's not sustainable in the long term because it's not good for your work-life balance. So I don't recommend to do it for 5 years. But I did it roughly for a year. And I even told my company. So I was actually quite, you know, very straightforward and honest about it. And I think I even signed a tiny contract just saying like they know that I'm doing this. And, you know, it's like there's no copyright or anything infringement. Yeah, I did this, and then I swapped to doing it full-time with no job as an unemployed with some support from a couple of people I knew. And then one of the big milestones that changed everything was Kickstarter. So going to Kickstarter, and that's one thing. But again, go to Kickstarter with something. Don't just go with an idea. We had already like a concept. I had a whole world that was built, and we shared the lore out there. We had a prototype that was playable. Even if you know, we didn't actually put it out on the internet, but you know, we had videos with where we're playing it ourselves and showing it and all these things. So we had something.
Yep. Okay, this is interesting. Your experience in mobile, in casual games like Candy Crush, and then in Wooga, and now you have your own company, Twin Drums, and make the game role-playing MMO. So my first question, why do you want to make this game?
Yeah, so question I ask myself every morning when I wake up. it's really important. And I mentioned that I spent a lot of time on Ultima Online many years ago in my life. And in general, like, I really like the concept of online role-playing games. I love role-playing games in general. Like, I've mentioned Dungeons & Dragons as well. I've been running D&D games for more than 20 years as a hobby. It's something I really have been doing since I was a teenager, and I really love. I've played lots of single-player role-playing games and some, you know, multiplayer. And I think there is still, like, a missing spot in the market for people who want to role-play, so actually act out, you know, speaking character in the game online with other people. So not just at a table with other four or five friends and a DM, but literally just log in, go online, and then kind of role-play your character. That's one thing. Another thing that was missing is a world that is, like, African-inspired. So you have a lot, of course, like, Eurocentric. You have a bit East Asian, but, you know, we don't see that much for other parts of the world. You know, like, Africa is one very underrepresented continent. I feel Southeast Asia as well, so I really want to see, you know, I'd love to play, like, some Indonesian-inspired MMORPG, so I'm waiting for someone, one of the listeners, or you maybe, to work on it. yes. So I think these kind of two elements, the desire to create a space for role players online, which is a bit niche, but I think it's large enough to be economically viable, and an African-inspired fantasy. You know, like, people were talking a lot about Black Panther, which is a bit more science fiction, but, you know, we don't see a lot of this. People are very excited. So these are the two things I want that kind of brought me there.
I see. And building, like, MMO is not, I don't know, is it easy in my imagination? Like, is it hard? Because not only just the game, but also the online part, the server part, and something like that. And maybe the cost is higher than making some small indie games with a good narrative, something like that. How do you manage to, like, assemble everything, like the funding, the team with the right skills to actually execute the idea?
Yeah, it's a great question. One thing I have to say, I'm kind of a bad example from this point of view because I picked one of the most difficult genres to go indie. I think one thing in my favor, I can say my defense, is that in the last years, it has gotten easier to do online games and to do, you know, multiplayer online game, massively multiplayer online games, compared to, like, 10 years ago. I think 10 years ago, just Twin Drums could not have existed with the Wargado Chronicles. We'd have had to do, like, probably a single player game or something else. But now the technology is getting there. The pipelines are much easier. Procedural content, we do use procedural, for example, content creation, has advanced so much in the last decade. Procedural, by the way, for listeners, is when you have these algorithms that generate kind of random, and I mean random, quote unquote, because there's parameters, right? But imagine, like, procedure is like you press a button and then it generates, and you just say, like, create a savanna island, and it generates, like, a random island with, like, some mountains and stuff and monsters and so on. And this type of technology has really developed and changed and gotten better in the last years. It allows, like, for instance, smaller teams not to require a team of, like, 20 level designers. Of course, if you have 20 levels, it's handcrafted, and it's still a bit of, like, it's a bit different if you handcraft it. But nowadays, the procedural content is so good that you can actually almost make it feel like, you know, handcrafted. Maybe you can edit it a bit so it feels handcrafted. So it becomes almost more of a curation. And this speeds up a lot. For, like, big games like MMOs, procedural, you know, and speaking with other indie MMO developers, they do a lot of, you know, many of them are thinking, or they're already doing some procedural content. We will use procedural even for questing. So actually, when you go to a quest for an NPC, the NPC is generated procedurally. So it will say, like, oh, friendly snake spirit that likes mangoes or something. And this is all generated. And then when you speak with it, it will generate a quest that says, like, recover X amount of this and this from so-and-so. And it might even chain the quest with something else. And this is all not manually written by someone, by a narrative designer who sat there for a whole day and was writing lines and lines. It's more like the code has these flexible dialogues and variables that generate all of these quests. And you as a player, you get potentially endless, you know, it's not really endless, but like, you know, really high amounts of things that can happen because the computer is generating it from you, for you while you're interacting with it. And these kind of technological innovations are allowing a small team like ours of 13 people to work on a potentially really big game like an MMORPG. Of course, we have other things we're doing. It's like a top-down game. We're not doing like a... it's like the graphics is not like super hyper-realistic. It's more like a bit more cartoony. You know, many things we're doing to cleverly make it manageable. But of course, this side is still a very big game and still a big challenge, but doable.
I see. Yeah, because when I heard like this game is like MMO, like, wow, well, how big is the team making an MMO games? And how about your experience in, you say you try to get funding in Kickstarter. How is your experience with the Kickstarter?
Yeah, a comment, by the way, on the team, there's even like an MMO, I think 1 Hour, One Life, that was developed at Jason Rohr, I think is his name, by one developer. He made everything himself. So, it, you know, it's like 2D graphics, very basic and so on, but it was very successful as well and sold a lot of copies. So you're just saying like now, I'm not saying you should go and do an MMO by yourself. It's probably not a good idea, but it exists, you know. You know, look at Stardew Valley 2. It's not an MMO, but you know, like a role-playing game done by one person. These are edge cases. I think we shouldn't be looking at this as normal, but it just shows you how the technology now allows you potentially with a very small team, up to one person, to do things, right? Yeah, but back to your question on Kickstarter, it's a whole other talk. There'll be another call me and you in future. But I'll say preparation was a big factor. Lots of preparation, lots of research, building some social media. Kickstarter should be the culmination of a journey, of you building a newsletter, building a Kickstarter audience, sharing some content and so on. And then comes the Kickstarter. Going to Kickstarter to announce everything and kind of starting from scratch, the day one of Kickstarter, doesn't work. Maybe it worked years ago, it doesn't work anymore. Now, Kickstarter is, people even cancel Kickstarters if they realize after a few months of building and so on and building some traction, they don't have it. They rather cancel, postpone the Kickstarter. Kickstarter should be there when you have something like a baseline already of things going on, like in your community for the game.
Do you make Kickstarter campaign because you need the funding, or you already have all of your funding and you need to build the hype in the Kickstarter?
Both. Yeah. So yes is the answer. Yes, everything. So we need the funding, but we're kind of building a community as well, building awareness. It's good for publishers, future publishers as well. We did have actually just before the Kickstarter, actually managed to get some funding just before. So that was really like going, the situation was quite good. But if that hadn't happened, so Riot Games awesomely decided to support us and give us some financial backing before. But if that hadn't happened, then definitely the Kickstarter would have been the main tool for me to then continue that conversation. But then, but anyways, it was useful absolutely in any case because it had to build, get more money, build a community. And then later on, now I'm in a situation where we don't have a publisher yet, but I am in talks. And I can say, look, we have some funding from Riot Games that supported us and believed in our project. We have some backers on Kickstarter that believe that this is going to be a cool game, that, you know, they overbacked the project. And, you know, we managed just recently to get some funding, a grant from the German government, which is super awesome. Ah. So now we have like all of this traction and now going to publisher with this plus, you know, kind of the pre-alpha version of the game that we're currently working on. You know, the more the better. So if you can add more things, just keep on adding and adding and adding on top of like your team and potentially the previous experiences and the CVs of the team and anything you can add to the package, put it there because it's hard. It's hard to raise money. And to find a publisher. So just do anything you can.
Yes. By the way, you already got funding from Riot, from Germany, from Germany government, and from Kickstarter. It's already like validated. There's a community that will support your game. Why do you still need publishers?
Very good question. So I can say there is a scenario in which Twin Drums self-publishes the Waugadu Chronicle. It's not completely impossible. And we have some ideas on this. I mentioned as well a background in marketing before game design. So I wouldn't be myself. I'm not terrorized by marketing as maybe some devs are. At the same time, maybe because I know marketing as well, I know how challenging it is and how easy to underestimate it is. You know, lots of very good game devs, indie devs, have awesome games, and then they go to Steam and the game flops, not because the game is bad, but because they had no clue how to do marketing. Or maybe they had some ideas, but they just postponed it because they were so busy, so much into the bug solving and everything and trying to solve their beta. And then, you know, whoops, it's release date and they haven't done. So I don't want to understand. I realize how important it is. I actually am seeing like a partner who's an expert in this and that can take over. Not all, because I think this, as an indie, it's still nice to keep some contact with the audience and social media and so on. But most, especially like the more like heavy lifting of like Facebook marketing, dealing with platforms, PR, and like going to events, all these things. Like for a small team like us working on an MMORPG, if we can outsource this, that's better. But yeah, so this would be the main reason. Kind of like it's important marketing and having someone who's an expert and taking it over is great. Plus, often they can contribute financially to the game and maybe allows us to create even more content, you know, and maybe add a couple of features that we're not planning to add, but we can add because of them. So I think there's lots of benefits. Of course, it means that you're kind of on a marriage with this organization, and marriages, as we all know, don't always end up nicely. Yeah. So it's a risk. So there's pros and cons. And I think depends on your game, on your situation, assess it very carefully, speak with other indie devs, investigate. It might be a good scenario for you, or maybe you don't need it. In our case, I think we could benefit a lot. But this said, we haven't signed anything yet, and there is both scenarios still open for us.
I see. That's interesting. Yeah, because you already know what to do in marketing, and sometimes developers forget to do about it, right? So it also having publishers. By the way, Alan, you mentioned that these games want to bring like something new about the culture in Africa. And like how do you see the animal, like the receipt from the audience? Like, is it, can they accept something that is new, that is something not familiar with them as a gamer who usually play like the most common topics?
Yep. So great question. You know, there's of course always a risk when you do something new, because you're like, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But one thing I can say is, if you look historically, for instance, at how, let's say, Japanese mythology or Japanese fantasy spread in the West. If you mention samurais, now literally everybody in the world, in the West and the rest of the world, know what a samurai is. They know, you know, like lots of the iconography or kind of elements of like Japanese-inspired fantasy or magic or so on are mainstream, based, I would say the mainstream now, you know, to the point that you literally have Western game developers using these traditions or visuals or so on for their own games, sometimes well, sometimes not so well. And this is a good example for me of like how cultures can kind of blend and grow and mix each other. And I think the reason why it happened a lot for Japan, and let's be blunt, is because Japan is very rich. So they had the resources and the money to just kind of like, you know, if Kenya or you know, like Namibia or Nigeria had been as rich as Japan, I think we would have like 50 the Wagadu Chronicles already out there, and people would be talking about, you know, the I don't know, Zulu warriors as like kind of like samurais, kind of like a trope where people, you know, have that weapon and that thing, and they use it in other games as well. So I think the history of colonialism, and I mean, let's not forget that Japan was a colonizing country, even if, you know, they do have to deal with racism in the West, they still were colonizing, and they benefited from, you know, this system that made them wealthier later on. Whereas like other countries were colonized and or impoverished and are still struggling with the legacy, most African countries are. So there's like a, you know, we can enter like this whole geopolitical thing, but I do think the reasons why we don't see this, that is not because people don't want to see more like African mythologies and aesthetics and so on. It's just because the resources haven't been there, and people just haven't had the chance. You know, I'm one of the first people with African heritage or African to do it. And hopefully many more, and I think it's happening, it's slowly changing, many more will do that.
Is there any support from the government, like from African government in your country, to push this game because it's promoting their culture?
Yeah. So in Ghana specifically, there isn't. And I'll say most African countries don't. And it's understandably because, you know, they have other much smaller budgets than, for instance, Germany. And so they have to focus on, you know, other resources. And I understand, as much as I love gaming, I do understand that building hospitals comes as a priority. Entertainment is super important. You know, in my career, I've had people emailing me on past games I worked on, like that helped them deal with PTSD, helped them deal with, like, you know, reconnect with like their dying grandmother, playing games together, like really beautiful stories. But again, you know, like building schools is more important. So I understand like most African governments don't have a budget for this. There is slowly some first signs of like trying to give a bit of space, at least visibility and support to tech companies, and which includes games. But it's a very early stage. I see some countries like Kenya, South Africa doing some first steps, especially in Nigeria. But it's a long way, and I think it's better. Yeah, like I had the luck privilege of having a European passport, which allowed me to stay here and get access to the German fans. And I know that's something not everybody can do. But things are changing. Like recently, I just saw that there was a new fund created for African game developers. Yeah, like it was quite a small one, but I think created by a bunch of Western publishing supporters. Riot Games as well created the fund. The funding that we got was specifically for underrepresented creators. So they were looking for interesting projects created by people who, like me, have like, you know, different backgrounds and are not just like the typical white cisgender male Western developer. So things are changing. There are things that, so look out, there's stuff. But I think governments, it will be a while before governments themselves. I don't know how the Indonesian government is, but I can say the African ones are definitely a bit behind on the topic.
Wow, this is a really interesting topic, but I think we already passed the limit of 1 hour. There's still a lot of things that I want to discuss with you, but hopefully we can have you again in this podcast in the next season if you're still available. Okay, Alan, so for to close our discussion for today, do you have any tips for all the new game developers who want to start their career in game development?
Yeah, so two tips, I'd say. One, do a ton of research. Like in as I said, go on LinkedIn, look at other people, really read blog posts, read articles, look at YouTube videos, and just research everything, you know, about the role, about the companies, you know, Google all of the companies, look at them, look at the history, look at what they're doing. And so learn as much as you can. It's really going to pay off. And the second tip is don't give up, because sometimes you'll feel like it's very hard. It's not the easiest industry to get into, but it will pay off. You'll manage. We all were at that point earlier on where we thought it was maybe not possible to get in, and then we managed. So don't lose hope, and there's a place for you as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Alan. So that's it for today. I hope this episode can give you insight and courage to press start your career in game developers. I am Adam Marisa Smita. Keep playing games, start making games. Thank you, Alan. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Adam. Bye.